part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate you jumping on. I'm actually a very big fan of yours. I was a very, very big fan. I am a very big fan of The Sixth Gun. So, like,
awesome.
A series that I enjoyed very much in years gone by. Let me just get started off by saying that this is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. My name is Christian Horn. We have a very, 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 very special guest on the line today. We have Cullen Bunn, who is a writer, a creator of many, many, many things. One of my favorites being, I just mentioned, The Sixth Gun. I used to love that series. I've also enjoyed many of your other works. So thank you so much for coming on to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. I'm so happy to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the reason that we have you on, I usually like to say, like, right off the bat, I mean, besides the fact that I'm a fan, I don't want to kiss your butt too much, but I am a fan of your work. You have a new book out called A Legacy of Violence, correct?
Yeah, the first issue just came out from Mad Cave.
Yeah.
It's the first issue of a 12 issue series.
Oh, okay. So it's a limited series. I wasn't quite sure if it was ongoing or so. It's only going to be 12 issues. Gotcha.
Yeah. It'll be 12 issues and, you know, and then that wraps up that storyline.
Nice. Nice. Well, I mean, I really enjoyed it. I loved it. I should say that I'm very much a fan of this sort of thing. Very obviously a fan of yours, a fan of horror, that sort of thing. And that's kind of like what it's based in, right? I mean, it is a horror comic, right?
Yeah, it's a horror book. It's a little different from a lot of the horror stuff I do because I do a lot of dark fantasy, a lot of horror, but I tend to gravitate towards supernatural horror and magic and, you know, monsters,
yeah,
things like that. And this book is very much grounded in the real world. It's not a story about it's not a story about monsters in the supernatural sense, although it is very much a story about monsters in the sense of how humans can be monstrous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's a very cool first issue. It got me engaged right away. And I actually kind of have like an odd question after, I mean, I read it twice. I read it one, obviously, several days ago, and then I read it again this morning to prep for this interview. But kind of an odd question to ask of a writer or the creator. The visuals of the book reminded me a lot of like Gene Colan's old work. I mean, maybe not as dense as far as like the brushwork and the dark inks and stuff like that, but it has this sort of like painterly quality to it while I was reading it. And I was looking through the book and I was like, oh, wow, this reminds me a lot of like Gene Colan, like Tomb of Dracula, like stuff like that. Was that done on purpose? Like, was that something that you were going for when you were looking for an artist, or am I completely off base in my analysis of the artwork?
Well, you know, it's not something like I didn't put that in the script or the initial pitch outline I wrote. I never said, you know, let's do something with sort of a Gene Colan vibe.
Sure. Right?
But as soon as Andrea Muti came on board, as the artist, and I've worked with Andrea a few times now, I knew what he was going to do with the book. I knew kind of, I had in my mind a pretty good idea of the way the book would look because I'm just familiar. He has a very distinct style. And like I said, I've worked with him a few times. So that may have come through in the script. Maybe I wrote things in a way that I knew it would, you know, I kind of had in my mind the way Andrea would draw it, but no, that wasn't the most I did. You know, sometimes in my outlines, I'll put like visual references, and I did do that for this. I take that back. I did it in the outline. I put some like, you know, here are books and movies that visually are very similar to what I have in mind for this. And then I also, for this book, and I haven't looked at it in a while because, you know, like I said, it's 12 issues, so it's been a while since I put this together.
Sure.
I did like a Pinterest board, a mood board for the series, and I just loaded tons of images into it that I wanted Andrea to see as he started working on it. I don't think there's any comic art in that, now that I think about it. It was all, you know, real world art or real world images. But yeah, so that's the most that I do when I get into, you know, I'll describe characters, obviously, if they need to be described. I'll describe like the villain of this piece I described, but I don't really try to. One of the things I always dislike, and you hear it from editorials sometimes at different publishers or different editors, and they'll say, you know, really draw this like this artist.
Sure.
Like, well, if you wanted it drawn like that artist, get that artist to draw it. Because, sure, you know, Andrea has his own style. And I think it's perfect for this book. But I don't know that I've ever talked to him about it, but I would hazard a guess that he absolutely has Gene Colan on his list of, you know, big influential artists.
Sure, sure. Why wouldn't you? That's one of the things I am a big fan of, is like the old Tomb of Dracula stuff and his work.
Sure.
And while I was reading this, it very much reminded me of that kind of like vibe a bit. I mean, obviously this is not supernatural horror like you mentioned before. This is sort of more grounded in reality. But while I was going through it, I was like, what is it that's so familiar to me about this? And obviously it's not like exactly like Gene Colan, but I was like, oh, there's a looseness to it. There's, you know, I love.
Yeah, I see it.
Oh, I'm sorry. What was that?
I see it for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just like, oh, wow, this is, and it adds to the creepiness of it. You know what I mean? It's so well done because obviously we haven't even gotten into the story. I asked you about the visuals first. I apologize. But do you sort of want to go into like the elevator pitch about what the series is about?
Yeah, it's this book, it's a very dark horror story. It's about it follows the story of this young doctor, Nicholas Shaw, who goes through some traumatic experiences, and he has to these experiences are so terrible and they haunt him that he leaves the United States and joins like a Doctors Without Borders and goes to Honduras to help a village there. But as he starts helping the village and starts meeting the other doctors that he's working with, he finds that sort of something sinister has followed him to this village. And not only has it followed him to this village, it may be there waiting for him when he arrives. So it's almost as if he's following this sinister power. And it starts drawing into some very surreal moments of Nick's past. And we find that as the series goes along, we find that Nick has a connection to this sinister figure that is stalking him.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because now that you've said that it's 12 issues and, you know, I've only read the first issue and I'm like, oh, wow, there's a lot that we have to uncover here because there is a mystery as to, I mean, it's right. It's not that he just goes and joins Doctors Without Borders. There's sort of like an inciting incident that makes him do that. Correct.
Correct. There is an inciting incident and it may even seem a little random maybe, to him, to Nick, but, the question really is it random? And while while this isn't a supernatural book, it's weird as heck. I mean, there's a lot of weirdness to this story. And so I compensated for the lack of supernatural with a lot of weirdness as you go along.
Well, sure. And I mean, I don't think I'm spoiling anything because it's on the cover, but there is a character that sort of wears kind of like I don't know how else to describe it, like a skull mask, or it seems evocative a little bit of the Punisher, like that sort of thing. Obviously, because I'm a comic fan, that's kind of the thing that I jump to, although not a huge fan of the Punisher as a character. but I'm just wondering, it's funny because you sort of based it in reality, but there still is that sort of fantastical element of the sort of antagonist that wears like kind of a mask that is sort of a staple of horror for the past, what, 40, 50 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that mask is inspired in that Pinterest board I set up for Andrea. I went out and researched like ceremonial Central American masks. And cool. That mask, I put a bunch of those in that Pinterest. So that mask is inspired by these ceremonial masks that I stumbled upon while doing some research.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. No, I guess, so one of the things that I was kind of curious about, I mean, I did notice that, and you mentioned that this is different than supernatural horror. It's more grounded. What was it that made you do that shift towards a more sort of, I guess, realistic, quote unquote, sort of horror story? Was it just something that you had been edging to do or been wanting to do, or were you just kind of like tired of the supernatural edge that you'd had into your stories and want to try something different?
Well, I'm always interested in trying, you know, some different things and exploring the different sort of subgenres of horror. Now, in this case, the initial idea for this book was actually brought to me by the folks at Mad Cave.
They
came to me and they said, hey, we really want to do this book. It's, you know, we have a very, I mean, when I say the idea, it was a very, very high level, like paragraph pitch for what they, you know, for the kind of book they wanted to do. And that kind of kicked me on. I was like, okay, this is a great opportunity to, one, work with Mad Cave, but to do this book that is a little different from what I've done before. And I just took it and I blew that paragraph that they gave me. I blew it out into several page document and just kind of ran with it from there. And that's where it came from. So the initial pitch that they gave me, it was actually pretty open. It could have been it was so loose. It could have been a supernatural story. It could have not, you know, it could have been almost any kind of story. But as I started kind of digging in and expanding that initial paragraph, I just thought that doing something real world but weird was the right move for this.
Oh, wow. I mean, I want to get to the Mad Cave stuff in a bit because that now that I'm even more fascinated because one of my questions would have been like, why work with Mad Cave? I mean, you've been, you know, with lots of like huge publishers. I mean, you know, you've worked with, you know, Marvel and DC and, you know, other, you know, indie publishers, and Mad Cave is kind of like an up and comer. But I mean, that sort of to me is a little bit of a question for later, because now I kind of want to focus on what you were talking about. Like if they gave you like a pitch of a paragraph and you're sort of constructing the story and you saw like a way to go, was the supernatural thing a thing that you were trying to like pair away from, like maybe you would veer towards it and be like, no, I don't want to do that. Or did this story sort of like develop organically as you were going along?
Yeah, I didn't necessarily say I would, you know, veer away from it if it started to get supernatural.
Sure.
It just, this was the story that felt right for me with this. It's as I was putting it together, and my initial document was several pages long and it was a rambling, weird, you know, when I'm kind of brainstorming, my documents are long and rambling and maybe hard to read, but I was working on it, this is what felt right. You know, it felt like that. And I knew there'd be a bit of a challenge to it. And I like the idea that there would be a challenge to writing something without any supernatural elements.
Sure. Sure. So, I mean, this is fascinating to me because as a creator, you're given sort of like a paragraph pitch. And did you know, was their thing like, we need this to be 12 issues or we need this to be 6 issues? Or was that something that you established? Because to take sort of like a paragraph pitch and, you know, whether it was a paragraph or a long paragraph or a short paragraph, you know, I don't know. But how do you expand that whole idea into something that fills up 12 issues and is obviously entertaining and engaging? Like, I mean, maybe this is too much like diving into the kitchen to make the soup, but I'm very curious about like how, you know, when does it, how do you make yourself stop? Like, why isn't it 24 issues? Why isn't it 6? Why isn't it, well, like, am I making sense?
Yeah, no, you are. When I first started talking to Mad Cave about it, I had a number of questions, you know, up front. You know, a lot of them were things like, all right, this is your initial paragraph, but are you going to let me treat it like a creator-owned book? Which means you're not going to get in the, you know, I don't want anyone to get in the way once it starts, you know, starts down the path. And you know, they were very open that, no, this was, you know, this was going to be my baby once I took it from them. But I had a number of questions, and one of them was, what is, you know, what's Mad Cave's appetite for this series? How long will you let me do a book? You know, and they said, their answer was basically, they didn't want it to be an ongoing series, but it was open to what I felt was right for the book. And I kind of toyed with that a little bit. I have been doing a lot of 12-issue series for Boom. So I did a book called Bone Parish for Boom. That was a 12-issue series.
Yeah.
And I did a book called Basilisk that just wrapped up. That was a 12-issue series. And I really like that format. You can get a really good story. It doesn't feel rushed, but it also, you know, the best stories have endings. And it felt like I was moving towards an ending. So the most important thing is, I knew how this thing was going to end. Would Mad Cave give me the opportunity to tell the story the way I wanted it to, and, you know, to tell it the way I needed to in order to get to that ending? And they were very open to it. So when I turned in that pitch of my version of it, I had at the end of the document, it said, and this is how the series breaks out. And I basically said, in issue one, this happens, and it's like a sentence or two for each issue, 1 through 12. I wrote a sentence or two for every issue of the book. And some of them very loose, you know, some of it's very loose and some of it's very specific. But I wanted them to know that I had a roadmap of where it was going to go.
Okay. Oh, that's really cool. I mean, what's interesting to me is, like, how does it, because, like, with Mad Cave, I've interviewed several of their creators on this podcast before, and quite honestly, I mean, a lot of them tend to be very indie, like up and coming, and, you know, not with a name like yours, who's been around for years and had a lot of success and stuff like that. I'm not saying that these creators were not, you know, of merit or didn't have success. I'm just saying, like, you have a recognizable name in the comic book industry. How do they approach you like that? Because, I mean, you know, these days it's all about, like, ownership and wanting to have, right, like, the rights to things and maintaining your own creator rights if you're going to do something indie. How does that work with Mad Cave? Do they approach, like, your agent and be like, hey, we've got something for Colin Bunn? Did they find you at a convention? Like, how did that necessarily work? And if you're approached with something like that, I mean, you did just say, like, oh, I wanted to know if they were, like, all in, like, going to commit to it, like I was going to commit to it. But how does that work for you? Are you like, hey, wait a minute, I don't know. Was this something new for you, or do publishers approach you like that often?
Yeah, it happens pretty regularly. I get, you know, I'll have publishers or editors reach out. I want to say with Mad Cave, and it's been a minute now, they either reached out on Twitter, like through a direct message.
In fact, wow.
I'm pretty sure they sent me a direct message on Twitter.
Oh, wow.
And then we set up a phone call from that to have, you know, some initial conversations. So it happens a lot. Yeah. Twitter. I mean, the first project I ever did for DC, for instance, you know, I don't know, 12 years ago, however long that was, that came through Twitter, a direct message on Twitter. So Twitter has been Twitter is a very active conduit of people reaching out to me, it seems.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, now you're going to get tons of people just like being like, hey, Cully, can you work on my thing, like on my property?
Yeah.
So, I mean,
that's fine. I mean, like I said, I get a lot of those. And a lot of the times I have to say, sorry, you know, it's just not right. You know, sometimes the project's not right for me.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm not right for the project. You know, there was a time in my life where I would take any work that someone was willing to pay me for because that's what you do.
Yeah.
But there are projects that I am not the right guy for. And I need to, you know, and I try to keep that in mind. You know, is it something I can bring something to? Is there something, you know, is it something that's going to, that I'm going to elevate the work by working on it? And if the answer is yes, and it's something that excites me, well, then there's a better chance that I'm going to work on it. Then there are conversations, obviously, about payments and rights and everything else, which is different for every publisher, every editor, and every project.
Sure, sure. And so are you considered like the sole creator of this, like in your, like, I mean, or is it like co-ownership, or how did that work with them?
Well, it's considered a creator-owned project.
Okay.
And that's happened a few times before. It's where I've had other publishers who've come and said, hey, we really want to do a project about, whatever. And if I develop it and that's not always the case. Sometimes, no, the publisher keeps the rights, but then it all comes down to payment and everything else. Like you said just a few minutes ago, these days more and more ownership is a very important part of the equation.
Sure, sure. I mean, it's fascinating. Was there, do you remember if that paragraph was included in their direct message? Like, were they like, hey, this.
No, it wasn't. It was basically sort of an introduction message. Hey, we'd love to talk. And we set up a time to call. And then on the call, we discussed just a couple of things, if I was interested in doing some work. And we discussed, they had an anthology they put out called Mad Tales from the Cave.
Uh-huh.
Which was a graphic novel anthology. So they asked if I was interested in doing a story in that. And then they said, and we have some ideas. We have an idea we'd love to run by you. And they sent me, a concept. And that's when they sent me the paragraph via email.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating to me, because what I hear from creators a lot is more of them going to companies and pitching their projects and stuff like that.
That is with creator owned stuff. That is far more common. Absolutely. Okay. But occasionally it'll happen. It can happen in a number of ways. You can have a publisher or an editor who says, hey, I really have a very specific kind of, like this. They're like, this is sort of, we want to do a book like this. And they had a paragraph, right? And then sometimes the publisher will say, we want a horror book, or, we want a science fiction meets horror book or something like that. It's just something that they feel they need for their catalog. But far more often it's sending pitches and, without any prompting. But there are, many different ways of getting those books out there and publishers working on those books.
Sure, sure. I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, it must be a good feeling, right, to have people coming to you as opposed to you chasing it down, right?
Well, that's all. It always makes it easier.
Yeah.
Definitely makes it easier.
Nice. So, I mean, they came to you with the concept and you were... I mean, you obviously saw something in it, and then you break it down, and then they come back to you and they're like, oh, ready. We're done. We love it. Like, let's go. And then you're on to full script.
Yeah. In this case, I went pretty much directly to full script.
Oh, wow.
For each of the issues. I might have done a more detailed outline for the first few issues for them, but I know early in the process, it just shifted over to just doing the scripts.
Sure. And sort of just getting back to that idea of like expanding your ideas. I mean, what you had said was, you gave them like a couple of sentences as to what happens in this issue. How do you break that down and expand it in your own, craft or mind? Like, as far as like, okay, do you already have that in your head? Like, as far as like when you're crafting those like couple of sentences per issue, do you kind of already have an idea of like how it's going to go once you've set that down? Or is that more of just another exploratory process? Like once you start sitting down at your keyboard or pen to paper or however you do it?
It's a little of both for me.
Okay.
Sometimes, as I'm doing that real, unless it's a very high level outline, right? As I do that, in fact, I can read you. I just called it up. I can read you since issue one is out, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I can read you how I described issue one initially.
Oh, okay.
And it says, Shaw, that's the doctor, Shaw in Georgia, encounter with patient, leaving for Honduras, encountering a wounded man, someone watching. That's all I wrote for that.
Oh, wow. Really?
So I just had a very high level. Now, sometimes if I have very specific, and when I say that, some of what I just described is in the meat of the pitch, because it's several pages document. And so I wrote like almost like a, you know, a paragraph, you know, I wrote a detailed outline of the series. So this wounded man I mentioned, he's mentioned up in the document, up in the meat of the document. And so it's not like someone, you know, if you just read that and didn't read the rest of it, you'd be like, what the heck is this about? But it, you know, it's a little, you know, it's the descriptions are up in the main document, which pretty much at high level describes the series. You know, it says this is what this is. It describes the three acts of the series. And sometimes I have very specific, sometimes I don't. And then when I get into the scripting process, I'll take that. I'll say, okay, this is what these are sort of the main beats that need to happen in issue one. And I kind of go through several outline phases. I do an outline that it's not really an outline. I just write down all the things I think need to happen in the issue. And then I take those elements and I write them down again. And I break down how many pages each of them will take and where they would fit in order in the issue. And then I kind of, and that phase goes through several passes. And then I do a detail outline that really describes everything that's going to happen on every page. Yeah. And then I go from that detail outline, I take that and I go to the actual script.
Oh, okay. And when you're doing script, I'm assuming that it's detailed panel by panel, like that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. I almost never, you know, I know some people still work in the old quote unquote Marvel style.
Yeah.
Almost never. Never for me. I mean, I've only done it a couple of times. And usually it's at the request, like, you mentioned the Six Gun earlier. There was an issue or two where Brian, there were two issues of the Six Gun where Brian said, hey, let's try a different format for the script, because he had something very particular in mind of how he wanted to draw it. And we did like a Marvel style script one time, and we did it some completely different way that we made up on the fly for another issue. Uh-huh. But almost every time I'm writing a panel by panel description script.
Gotcha. One of the things I wanted to ask, this takes place in the 80s, or at least the main story does take place in the 80s. Is there necessarily a reason for that? I mean, I know a lot of horror creators these days like to avoid the modern day because of like cell phones and internet and all that sort of thing. There's also a big trend of like, well, it seems like now we're heading into 90s nostalgia, which is weird because the 90s seem like they were nostalgia for the 70s and 80s. Anyway, yeah. But I mean, what is there a reason for setting it in the 80s in particular?
There is a reason. It was not done for the sake of nostalgia to the 80s. It wasn't. And the fact of, you know, no cell phones and things like that was a happy benefit of setting it in the 80s, but there is a story reason that it's set in the 80s. And it's something that you kind of find as you go along with the series. There's very specific reasons it could only take place in this era.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, I mean, there is a flashback to the 60s as well. And a lot of the mystery of this particular issue involves, and I mean, the book is already out, so I can say, like, involves something called Unit 731. And I mean, anytime there's sort of a story that takes place in the 60s and there's a sequence where there's older people like involved, like I'm thinking, yeah, and they're talking about the horrible things that they've done. And I don't want to spoil anything about the book, but I'm thinking like Germany. I'm thinking like World War II. I don't want to say anything like that. But I mean, there's definitely sort of a backstory or mystery going on here with the lead characters sort of like grandparents, that it sounds like they've done something horrible and maybe plays into the title of the book, which is A Legacy of Violence.
It does. And in fact, the book was at one time titled Unit 731.
Oh, interesting.
And then the title was changed. And Unit 731 is a real event in our history.
Oh, okay.
Which is where that initial paragraph that they, you know, that's really what drove Mad Cave. It was one of these things like, we really want to do a story that maybe deals with Unit 731. And then I took it, and this is a highly fictionalized version of that.
Okay.
So, the Unit 731 of it all really kind of guided the setting and where it would take place and the timeline and things like that.
Oh, I mean, since Unit 731 is an actual historical thing, can you shed some light on it, or will that spoil things? Do I have to go Google it? Should readers go, listeners go Google it?
I'd say Google it. It was during, you know, you were right on World War II, and there were, it was a group that was doing biological and chemical experimentation. And it's really it's more horrible than what I could cook up for the story.
Lovely. When you're doing research like that, how does that sort of like creep into you? Like, I mean, obviously you're a horror writer, right? And one of the things, I mean, I'm a horror fan. Like we do kind of like horror movie episodes like every week during the month of October, just because I enjoy horror movies and like to talk about them and stuff. But I mean, one of the things that sometimes when you dive too much into horror, it's like, oh, I got to take a step back. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, and one of the things that I've talked about in the past on this podcast is like when my daughter was first born, which was several years ago, like I couldn't look at any horror. I had to turn off all politics. I had to turn off, there's something in me that clicked. When you're sort of researching something like horrible like that, how do you sort of like detach, or do you just dive into it, have to go through the horribleness of it, deal with the depression of coming out? Like, how does that work for you?
Well, my answer is probably, when I was first working on this, it was probably a different answer because it was a different world for me.
Okay.
And things in life change, and maybe at this point I would probably pull back from it a little bit. I did enough research on this to be dangerous.
Okay.
And there are elements of the truth that I absolutely just did not want to write about. So I changed it.
Oh.
Because it's a comic book and I can do whatever I want.
Sure.
You know, so that's when I say it's highly fictionalized. There were lots of elements of the history of it that I took and I said, you know what, I'm throwing that out. And I'm gonna create something new. There's still elements of history to it, but this would definitely be an inspired by true events rather than based on true events.
gotcha. I mean, do you ever worry about people like sort of complaining about diluting the historical aspect of it, like the horribleness of it?
I'm sure that will happen.
Okay.
I mean, I don't worry about it so much, and I believe, and I'm not going to get into my reasons for making some of these changes,
sure.
I can say that I'm right for making these changes, and I would not do this comic if the changes weren't something I could do.
Sure.
I would have not done this, and not for a fact of, oh, I don't want to write it, but there were some elements of it that I thought didn't need to be in a comic.
Sure.
It didn't need to be something, and it definitely didn't need to be something that I was going to be putting out in the world.
Sure. Understood. Yeah. I mean, let me ask you that question. I mean, as a creator of horror, or you know, obviously it seems like you to create the stuff, you would have to be a fan of it. That's something that I've asked, you know, other creators in the past, like how much is too much? How far is too far? Do you just have a line in your own brain that you're just like, yeah, I don't want to do that. You know what I'm saying? Or
usually when it comes to the horror of it all, I don't necessarily have a limit where I'm like, okay, I'm not going to do this. It's just too, you know, the guideline I've given myself is I always want my readers, especially with a horror book, I want the readers to feel like there's a sense of danger and a sense of being harm, you know, of harm. But I never want these books to harm a reader. Mm. You know, I don't want something I do to genuinely harm someone. So I'm not gonna, you know, and I'm not a, you know, and that's not to say I you know, I will write about subjects that have that would have a, you know, quote unquote trigger warning on it, or that would trigger people. That's, you know, that's part of being a writer. Sometimes I write about things that make me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But if I ever get to a point where I'm writing something where I'm like, oh no, this could hurt someone, you know, this, you know, I try to veer away from that if I can. I don't want anyone to actually be harmed by the stuff I write.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can't control that, obviously. Sometimes you write something and it, you know, makes people uncomfortable. But that's never the, you know, it's not something I don't sit down and say, really going to stick it to him today.
Yeah. I mean, you're not setting out to be mean, which obviously right. There is some horror that out there that where you're just like, oh, that's just not right. I mean, I guess.
And I don't mind things not being right. I don't mind writing about things that aren't right either. So it's a very precarious scale of what I will and won't do. In the case of Unit 731, I changed some things that I just felt, like I said, it wasn't even that, oh, this is going to be too scary to write about. I just felt like it was not going to help. It would just not help in the world. So yeah. I just decided to change some things to make it. I still think it's scary. Still think there's lots of horrible things. And Unit 731 is still a scary concept. But there were just things I didn't need in the comic itself.
Sure, sure. You didn't need
to. Yeah, there will certainly be folks who, if they know their history, are going to say, you shouldn't have changed it or whatever. But again, it's a horror comic.
Yeah. I mean, at least in this first issue, to me, it's just hanging over it like a very sinister concept, which correct. Obviously to me is like, yeah, that's good enough. So, yeah. But I mean, I would imagine in your researching, you know, and I'm probably going to Google it as soon as we get off of this interview. I'm going to be like, I mean, I guess I know the basics because I deduced it. Like, but, you know, Google it, folks. I guess you don't need to.
It's an interesting story, an interesting piece of weird history. I'm sure there's, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of people will think about why something, you know, why I may have veered away from different elements of it.
Sure.
But yeah, it's an interesting story for sure.
Sure. May I ask you, you mentioned that the title changed and now it's called A Legacy of Violence. And one of the things I was trying to avoid was calling it like A History of Violence because of the Cronenberg movie. But I mean, A Legacy of Violence, is that a title change that you made or is that a title change that somebody else made?
That was a title change that came from Mad Cave.
Oh, okay. So
it was probably, you know, their marketing department or the sales team or editorial thought that it would better represent the book.
Gotcha.
So that actually came from Mad Cave.
Oh, that's so when they decide. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My biggest hesitation is just what you described. It's sort of close to, you know, a history of violence.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting because, I mean, it's sort of in the same way. I mean, since it is, it did remind me a little bit of that Cronenberg movie and probably one of his more sort of like less kind of gross ones, I would say, you know, sort of like a bit more of a mainstream. It kind of elevates it, too. I mean, I also really like the font design of the title, like, if I may say.
Yeah, the design and everything of it is great.
Yeah, but when they decide to change a title, is that something that you're like, oh, okay, like, that's fine? Or were you just like, really? How does that work for you as the creator?
It depends. I mean, if I really, you know, if I really hated the title, and that's happened plenty of times, you know, with other books I've pitched or whatever, if the title change comes up. Title changes are nothing unusual.
Okay.
In the world of comics, they happen a lot. And sometimes it's big debates. Sometimes there's, you know, sometimes I'm sending lists of dozens of different titles So it just depends. This one, I mean, there was no, I don't remember. It was fine. It wasn't something that it, there was no arguments or anything.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, it also is very fitting. Again, I mean, it sort of plays into the first issue. Again, I don't, I'm trying not to spoil or ruin anything, but I mean, the book is out for, but for anyone who hasn't read it, I mean, it, it definitely seems like, again, I mentioned the flashback to the 60s that mm-hmm. there is a legacy of like horror. Horrible things having been done that is creeping through to the present in the 80s in this book to affect the character right now, correct?
Right. And that, so, I mean, and in that way, the title is apropos.
Yeah.
It works.
Yeah. 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 I mean, it's interesting to me that sort of like a title, like a legacy of violence would also sort of be talking, I guess, about the nature of violence and how like violence begets violence, you know, an eye for an eye makes everyone blind. Is there any sort of thought to that sort of thinking into the sort of like making of this book?
Yeah. You know, it goes into it because this book goes into some very violent places. And that's, you know, you were talking, you know, earlier about, you know, are there things that you don't write about? And I was like, well, I remember when I was a college student, I wrote a story. I still have the story somewhere. And my professor wrote, he liked the story, but he felt like I was using violence to comment on violence. And he wasn't sure if he liked that or not. And I remember having that conversation with a professor that not about him liking it. It was a comment on violence. And this book does have a comment on violence, but it is through a lens of a very violent story.
Sure, sure. And what are your thoughts on that? I mean, as a creator of, you know, again, I don't know how many times I've used the term horror in this interview, but I must be breaking a record for it. But I mean, for you, like, what are your thoughts on that? Like just using violence or portraying violence and sort of media like that sort of thing? I mean, obviously there's different ways of sort of portraying things. Where do you sort of like fall on that spectrum? I mean, earlier you said you don't want to write anything that hurts anyone, but obviously this is a book or this, and it looks like as a, you know, I mean, we're just getting started here, folks. Like that's what's great about this first issue is that like, I've read the first issue and I'm like, I'm in, I want to read more. Like, here we go. And it sounds to me like things are going to get even more dark. How do you sort of fall as far as like, the portrayal of violence in comics, media, or anything?
Well, I feel like there's a, it has to fit the story that you're trying to tell.
Sure.
I could write another story and all the violence would take place off panel, so to speak, off sure. screen. If that's what fits that story. In this case, I felt like seeing that violence, seeing the results of the violence, it is integral to the story. It's integral to what I'm trying to do with it. And I think it will feel appropriate. I definitely feel like there are times, you know, sure, there are some stories that there's sometimes violence is used in other media and it's not necessary.
Sure.
And maybe I'm, you know, this is me saying this and I might be wrong. There, when it's plugged in just to say, hey, I'm going to make a violent scene. We're going to make this bloody just to be bloody. You can feel that and you know it. It's different from when the violence is there to, you know, to the violence is part of the story rather than just sort of wedged in for no real reason.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. One of the things I wanted to ask you about was the Doctors Without Borders stuff and the Honduras sort of trip or it shifting to Honduras. Was that sort of always a part of like your initial idea? Was that obviously the character does it to sort of get away from the inciting incident that sort of like starts in the beginning of the book. Why Doctors Without Borders? Why Honduras? Like why that sort of thing?
Some of that was in that initial paragraph and the initial discussion with Mad Jade.
Interesting.
So I knew that was something I wanted to look into about including. I mean, I think if I'd decided to cut it out, we'd have been fine with it, but it worked and it makes sense for where we're going with it. And the Honduras of it all has a story. There are story elements to that as well.
Gotcha.
There's a reason that we're setting it there.
I'm thinking about it. I don't want to say anything because I don't want you to spoil anything for me, but tying one thing into another in my brain, I'm sort of like, okay, Honduras, Central America, South America. Okay. Maybe we're going in a specific, I could be completely wrong and I probably am, but I'm just sort of like telegraphing in my own brain. Okay. Maybe I like, as far as Doctors Without Borders and stuff like that, did you have to do a ton of research on that?
Again, I did enough to be dangerous. So, if you dig in too much, you're going to find that you might find that I got some things wrong.
Okay.
But for the sake of the story and the sake of this world, I think it works. I did enough to make it. I did enough to make it seem like I know what I'm talking about. That's always my hope when I get into this. When I get into books that require a lot of research, I do enough to make it seem like I know what I'm talking about, but I try not to do enough that my research shows. Because nothing to me is more of a snooze than someone trying to prove how much they know about some subject.
Oh, that's really cool. I mean, I think that's an interesting take, like, because that's funny, because at one point it could just all become exposition and this is Doctors Without. And so for you, it's like enough to know enough, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's great. That's great. Well, I mean, since I've got you on the line and you are one of my favorite creators, writers in comics, and you are a horror creator, at least to me, forefront in my brain. I mean, I know you've done the superhero stuff, but again, The Sixth Gun was like one of my favorites from, you know, years gone by. And I went back and started looking at those trades recently because I bought the trades and the issues and all that. Anyway, the point being that... what are some of your favorite horror things? I mean, I'm sure people ask you this all the time, but since you're a horror creator, let me start by just asking you, like, what's the first horror thing that you remember being exposed to that you were like, oh, I like this, or oh, this freaks me out?
So there were a couple of things. Back when I was a kid, cereal boxes used to have records on the back of them.
Oh, yeah. So
you would cut the back of the box off and you could punch the record out.
Yeah.
This little cardboard record that would play on your record player.
Yeah.
And I got one that was like The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Okay.
And I must have listened to that thing a billion times. I loved that Legend of Sleepy Hollow. And I think that was, I don't know if it was my earliest exposure to, you know, things scary, but I remember going to, you know, my brothers and sisters were all 10 years older than me. And they were going to haunted houses and they were watching, you know, horror movies, and I'd sneak into the living room. I'd crawl across the floor and hide behind the couch and watch horror movies while they were watching them.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I was just always interested in that kind of stuff. And then, you know, then I kind of fell out of the – I was always interested in horror, but I kind of moved more towards fantasy for a while and science fiction for a while. And then I just, you know, eventually gravitated back into being – full on into horror stories.
Oh, gotcha. What was it that pulled you back in?
So, at some point in high school, I decided that I wanted to be a special effects makeup artist.
Oh, cool.
So I was really reading a lot of Fangoria and things like that. So I started reading Fangoria, and then I was watching a ton of horror movies to get the special effects makeup, you know, to kind of study the effects that they were using, the practical effects they were using. And then, you know, Fangoria reviewed novels and things like that. So I started really getting into the novels that I was seeing reviewed, and that just spun into other novels. And then it just kind of, you know, exploded from that.
Oh, wow. 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 That's great. That's great.
And then I never ended up doing any special effects makeup.
Did you ever try? Like,
I did it. You know, we used to put on haunted houses. My dad used to build houses, and there was always like an empty framework building somewhere. And we would, we'd put haunted houses on in those during Halloween for year after year. And we do all the effects for that and things like that.
That's
But never, I never ended up pursuing it as a career, really.
Sure. Do you still like, are you doing haunted houses at your own house now as an adult?
We do one in our garage every year.
Oh, that's,
yeah.
That's so cool. How, like, how much time do you devote to it? Are you like fully like hardcore, like one of those people that, you know, you'll see on documentaries and stuff?
No, I'm the guy who probably makes those people angry because I just kind of throw it together.
That's funny. Well, so, I mean, what's some of your favorite horror stuff? I mean, like movies or novels, or are you like a big Stephen King fan? Are you like a Dean R. Koontz? Like what?
Yeah,
what?
No, well, I definitely am a Stephen King fan. I liked, you know, and there's an era of Dean Koontz that I think produced some amazing horror novels. And then, you know, Clive Barker. I'm a huge fan of Thomas Ligotti, Bentley Little. You know, those are authors that I, you know, that I really enjoy reading. There's a short story anthology series called Borderlands that is just a great series of anthology that really pushes horror in some interesting directions, and it's the whole point of that series is doing something different with horror, and it's awesome. You know, movie wise, I love The Thing and Alien are probably my, those two movies vie for my number one horror movie position constantly.
Sure.
It's either one, you know, so I just said, okay, they're just tied. It's a tie for Alien and The Thing.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, I watch just like you. I mean, it's Halloween season.
Sure.
It doesn't need to be Halloween for me, but, you know, I watch at least a horror movie a night during October.
Oh, wow. That's great. Do you focus on trying to find new stuff, or do you just like stick with the stuff that you've seen before? Or like,
oh, it's a mix. I watch it. I mean, so far this year, I've watched mostly things I've seen before.
Okay.
That have the feel for the season. Like I said, I watch horror movies all the time, but I wanted to watch things that feel right for October and Halloween. So most of it's stuff I haven't, most of it's stuff I've already seen. Some of it I haven't seen in a while, but you know, I'm revisiting it. And then there's a few, like I just last night watched on Shudder. There's a new movie called Deadstream that just came out. That's really great.
Oh, really?
That I watched on Shudder last night.
Oh, okay, cool. I'll have to try and check that out. I had some problems with Shudder over the weekend. They don't let you resume the movie, like when you've ended it. I'm like, what's going on? I had to stop it and go back to it, and you got to fast forward through. It was a mess. Anyway, complaints about Shudder. That's not what this is about. Have you ever read any Robert McCammon?
Like his... Oh, Robert McCammon. Robert McCammon is one of my favorite writers.
Oh,
I should
me
have
too.
Mentioned him earlier. He and it's not a horror book, but. He has a book that still I consider my favorite novel, which is Boy's Life.
Yeah, I got to read that one. I haven't read that
Boy's
one.
Boy's Life, it's like I said, there's some horror elements to it, but it's not necessarily a horror novel. That's my favorite novel. But yeah, I love a lot of Robert McCammon stuff. He has a novella called Night Calls the Green Falcon, which is just awesome. He has a short story called Yellow Jacket Summer that I love. He has a great story called He'll Come Knocking at Your Door that you absolutely should read at Halloween time.
Oh, cool. I'm going to have to check that. My favorite is Swan Song, and I think I read Gone South like recently.
Yeah,
I believe that.
Yeah, Swan Song's a great, you know, great book. It's one, you know, people who like The Stand want The Stand to be a little more have just a tiny bit of an injection of comic book fun.
Yeah.
Swan Song is that, I feel like.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I'm a fan of Robert McCammon and all those.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Cool. Well, I mean, I know I've had you on for almost an hour, and I mean, I really appreciate your time and, you know, you taking the time to come on to the podcast. I mean, any final thoughts on A Legacy of Violence? I mean, this is only the first issue. We've got 12 issues left to go. Anything final you would like to say about the project or?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun book. Like I said, it's dark, and I think there are times where it'll surprise the readers of where we go with it and what's happening. There are going to be moments where the readers are going to be like, what the heck is this? And why did this, you know, why is this happening? You know, why did you make me read this? because we take our time with the 12 issues of setting up that, that mystery and letting it unfold and paying it off.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one of the cool things that Mad Cave has done with some of their other books that I thought was cool, I'm not sure that they're doing it with this, but I can't imagine that they wouldn't be, is they have kind of like a subscription service. So like you sign up for the digital ones and you get them, and then once the trade comes out, then they ship you the trade, which I thought
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, I thought that was like really cool. So that would be a way to sort of like keep up on this. I'm assuming it's in comic shops as well, correct?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, the book is called A Legacy of Violence. You are Cullen Bunn. I really loved this first issue. I mean, I can't say this is like a perfect Halloween read. So I would recommend anyone just run to their comic shop and get a copy, because I very much enjoyed it. And I very much enjoyed your writing on it, Mr. Bunn.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the book is called A Legacy of Violence, out through Mad Cave Studios. The gentleman I have been speaking with is Cullen Bunn. My name is Christian Horn. This is the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. You can check us out on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that wonderful social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy. Part-time fanboy.